Want more stories in your life without adding to your TBR? That's where Audible comes in. I use it for the original novellas, the Plus catalog like Deanna Reborn's Veronica Speedwell series, and those audiobook sales that you can beat. Right now, Audible has a special offer for new and returning members. Click the link in the show notes to see what deal you'll get and start listening today. Welcome to the What You Read Next podcast. In this podcast, your host, Lori Amin, will interview published authors to chat about their work, journey to getting published, and their book recommendations. If you share a passion for books and are always looking for your next read, then join us. Welcome to the What You Read Next podcast. Today's guest is Richard Kirschenbaum. Richard is a published author of the book Rouge and novel Beauty and Rivalry. In this episode, Richard talks how his experience inspired him to write this book, his writing process, and of course, around the book recommendations. Now let's get to the show. Hi, Richard. Welcome to What You Read Next podcast.
Hi, Lori. How are you?
Great. So happy to have you here. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, let's see. Well, I am a ad man and now a novelist. So it's been a dream of mine to become a writer. And I would say that it's been nice to, really achieve my goal. So I'm very, very happy to be here and talk with you.
Yeah. So how was your journey to start to writing a novel and just getting it published?
Well, you know, I would say that one of the things that's really important, I think, for people who want to do it is to take the long view. You know, I think what's really interesting is that, you know, in terms of my career, I think that, you know, everyone thinks that, you know, things are supposed to happen overnight, or, you know, you write the great American novel and, you know, you hand it in and that's the way it goes. It doesn't work that way. You know, I started out as a comedy writer when I was in my 20s, you know, making $8 a joke for Joan Rivers. I then became an advertising copywriter for the business and did campaigns for many years and ran an agency. Then I, you know, started, you know, writing, you know, different kinds of books and articles and, you know, some theater work. And then, you know, over time, about 3 or 4 years ago, I was asked to do a column in the New York Observer, and I came up with this idea of writing a column about rich people called Isn't That Rich? And Life Among the 1%. And the column really took off, and then that got sold to ABC, and then it got the attention of a lot of notable people like Liz Smith. And then that's when, you know, I sort of built up to getting a real book deal, you know, to, you know, do the novel. But again, it took a lot of time, a lot of effort, and things don't happen overnight. I'm not an overnight success in this.
Yeah, I think that's a perception that everyone's an overnight success. Like when we see, you know, who hits the New York Times bestsellers, who do this. And the reality is that it takes a lot of work, and it's a crooked path. It's not a linear path. It doesn't just happen. You just wrote a book and then you get published. Like there might be some setbacks. There might be some diversions. There might be some things that you do that will lead you to get to that place.
You're 100% right. But the journey, life is all about the journey. And quite frankly, you know, one of the things about getting a little older, there are some benefits, you know, not many, but there are some. Mm-hmm. And that's that you have, you know, life experiences are richer. You can write from a deeper level of authenticity, having experienced, you know, life's ups and downs. And I think that, you know, so much of that is important to the authenticity of the characters and how that, you know, how that works. So I would say that over time, you know, if you can access that into your writing, it's really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so true. So let's talk about your writing. Do you follow an outline or do you see where the story leads you?
Well, I think, okay, do I follow an outline or do it's truthfully, I learned a great lesson in writing Rouge. I mean, first of all, here's the best way to do it. I started with I think the best way to do it is start with an overall macro big idea. And then from there, it's important to create, you know, the characters. And if you create strong characters, and here's my lesson, and a plot line, the characters then, in a certain sense, if they're strong characters, they will write the book for you because the characters... You know, characters, if they're strong characters, will do certain things based on, you know, their personalities. And so, you know, if you are, if you create a strong enough character, the characters then in many ways write the book.
Yeah, I believe that's a big case from the books that I read, where the character is the one driving, you know, especially character-driven stories where there's a lot of depth around the characters that lets you to know what the story is going to look like or what the arcs are. So I can see that, you know, looking at it from that perspective seemed to be an easier way to write a story.
Yes.
So how do you organize yourself as a writer? How do you keep track of the ideas, inspirations, and characters?
I think, you know, inspiration, first of all, they say write what you know.
Yeah.
And I think when you write what you know, I think it's a really good rule of thumb. You know, it's much more authentic, and you can bring much more to it if you write what you know. So, you know, as an ad man, I handled for many years many cosmetic accounts. So I handled the Revlon account. I handled the Avon account. I handled John Frieda and Biore and, you know, a hair relaxer account called Cream of Nature. So, you know, for me, when I started writing about these women and the cosmetic industry, I know the industry and I know, you know, I've worked with very well-known women in my career. You know, everyone from, you know, Andrea Jung, who ran Avon, to Martha Stewart and, you know, Elaine Wynn, who, you know, with her husband, you know, really ran Las Vegas many, you know, for years. So, you know, I was able to not only, you know, understand the psychology behind really powerful women and entrepreneurs, but also really understand the category. And so I think that, you know, I was surprised that nobody had written a novel about the cosmetic industry and the founders of the cosmetic industry. And it is a based on novel. So that was a pretty good guide, and experience really helped, you know, in developing the plot in the book, and you know, as it all came to fruition. So I would say again, you know, everyone has unique experiences. Everybody's from somewhere different. Everybody is from a different culture. So you know, if you can tap into what makes it unusual about you or your experience, then it's going to be richer.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest case. It shows that you're not about cosmetics. It showed in the book that there's something that, you know, it reflected in the story. So it's great to hear that you do have the experience and that's what it reflected back into the book.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
So do you share your work along the way or do you wait until it's completed for others to read?
Let's see. Do I show my work to people? You know what I would say is that I definitely bounce the idea and the work off my wife, Dana, who I consider, you know, my muse. I mean, definitely, you know, she, you know, when I started writing my first column, the Isn't That Rich column for The Observer, you know, she gave me some comments and notes that were pretty harsh and, you know, wanted me to go back and do some rewriting. And, you know, and I think, you know, she, you know, really motivated me. Not everybody wants the criticism, but, you know, if someone tells you, you know, yeah, I really like that, but you really could, you know, Richard, that could be better. Like, you know, you could write it in a better style. You know, those are the things that sometimes people need to hear. So I always think it's important to show your work to people. You know, my editor at St. Martin's Press, Elizabeth Byer, I mean, she was just incredible. You know, she called me one day and she said, you know, I want these characters to kind of meet and like, you know, when I need a little bit more interaction. And one of the best scenes in the book, I think, came from her saying, you know, we need that, you know, and it's where the characters meet and, you know, they're coming out of, you know, a dressing room to get, you know, getting couture fitted for gowns, and they meet in the dressing room and, you know, the fireworks go off. So, I mean, I definitely attribute that scene in the book to Elizabeth, and, you know, I probably wouldn't have written that unless she gave me those cues.
That's really good to hear. Yeah, that was a powerful scene because you just, the characters were living parallels, but then there's a moment where they connect and there's like, you know, the rivalry shows up. So that was a really powerful scene. So I love that it was inspired by somebody else. That was great.
Thank you.
So now let's talk about Rouge. So Rouge is a fictionalized version of the feud between beauty icons of Helena Rubinstein and Elizabeth Arden. What inspired you to drive into the story as opposed to other cosmetic, you know, related stories?
Well, I think, you know, when I was writing Rouge, I really went back and looked at all the great beauty icons. You know, I looked at, you know, Helena Rubinstein, I looked at Elizabeth Arden, I looked at, you know, Estee Lauder, I looked at Madam C.J. Walker, I looked at Charles Revson. I mean, I looked at, you know, what I thought was interesting was that this was a category primarily built by women, mm-hmm. you know, the first multi-billion-dollar category at a time when women couldn't get loans mm-hmm. in the 1920s. So I thought that was fascinating. And I thought these women led fascinating lives. And very often their personal lives were, you know, turbulent. There were men, but I think for the most part, I mean, Madam C.J. Walker was one of the first African-American, you know, millionaires. I think the first, actually, female millionaire in her community. And I think that, you know, so I really drew inspiration from the greats. And, mm-hmm. you know, when you're doing a book like this, it's really a compilation character. Like, you know, so it's not specifically based on only one person, mm-hmm. but for the most part, you draw different things from different people. So, you know, and that's one of the things that's really wonderful about being able to create characters is that, and plot lines is that, you know, you can make the character, like if the character, you know, you want the character to do a certain thing, you know, like in the book, Constance is the society woman, you know, the society girl. But for whatever reason, she's the one who adopts the, you know, the Avon, you know, door-to-door model. Mm-hmm. And Josephine, who's, you know, the European emigre escaping the Holocaust, I mean, she's the, you know, she's the outsider, but she creates the prestige part of the business, the salon business. Mm-hmm. And so the tension in those two things also helped create a great rivalry, you know, and it would have been too easy just to make Constance, you know, the society girl who has the salon business and Josephine, the outsider who creates the door-to-door business, the mass business. It just would have been too easy, you know? And I think that the tension in that is what's interesting.
Yeah. The tension was it was palpable, and it was something that made the story drive, that it just gave you kind of like, you wanted to know what's next and you wanted to figure out like how these two rivalries would, you know, would come to blows at the same time, who actually continue to build their prestige and build their companies. So it was definitely an interesting story that it just allowed me to get to know this world and get to know strong female protagonists, which is one of my favorite things.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, both characters, well, all three characters were strong female protagonists who were savvy, who were, you know, smart, who were able to just kind of like finagle immense business, immense world, and then still set their own intentions as a female leading a business.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
So how much research did you conduct on, you know, in terms of getting to, you know, you mentioned that you have experience working in the cosmetic world, but this is historical fiction too. So how much research did you conduct to between the two beauty icons, the feud, as well as the other players in the business?
Yeah. I mean, research when you're doing a historical fiction is crucial. And I mean, thank God for Wiki and, you know, for, you know, the computer. You know, I mean, in the olden days, you know, we had to go to the New York Public Library and mm-hmm. check out books and things like that. So it's easier today. But still, there's an enormous amount of research that needs to be done. First of all, you have to understand, number one, you know, how these people lived in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, what they ate, how they traveled, you know, what technology they were using or not. And then you have to apply the timeline of history to it. And so, you know, as an example, you know, I remember one of the first scenes was, you know, Constance getting, you know, a drink with her brother, but then, you know, there was prohibition, so they wouldn't have gone to a bar. They would have gone to a speakeasy. And so, mm-hmm. you know, if you don't know that, you know, then it's not going to be authentic to the time period. So, you know, mm-hmm. again, you know, there was an enormous amount of research that had to happen. You know, like, you have to know when, you know, if someone's in Europe in the 1930s, like, you have to know when, you know, Germany invaded Poland and when they invaded France and, you know, and then there's, you know, the layered other parts of the book. You know, I brought in the McCarthy era and, you know, and then there's, you know, enormous amounts of other types of research that needs to be done. I mean, one amazing thing was, you know, we all know and have heard of the Cotton Club, and the Cotton mm-hmm. Club was, you know, one of the leading hotspots for, you know, an African-American hotspots in New York. But, you know, what I didn't know was that, you know, which was, you know, because it was segregated and, you know, during that awful period, you know, the African-American performers did not mingle with the all-white audience. And that was shocking to me when I read that, you know. And so, you know, for the most part, I thought, you know, there are certain things that you read and you research and that you that really hit you over the head, and you think, wow, you know, that's pretty interesting, and you know, that's not very pleasant. So, you know, those are the things that I wanted to make sure were brought out in the book. I did not want people to think that, you know, everything about this time period was glamorous or fun or easy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're writing about, you know, LGBT issues mm-hmm. and gender inequality and racism and anti-Semitism and the Holocaust and McCarthyism and many of the things that were so difficult for so many people, you know, you need to be real about it, and that's really hard. But if you don't have your research and you don't do your work, then, you know, you can't write something that's authentic.
Yeah, it reflected history. Like, I'm a history major, and so it reflected the things that I knew about history. At the same time, it just reflected, it wasn't like a pink cloud, like, everything's fine, everything's great. Like, no, it reflected, like, the Holocaust, McCarthy, all the different things that happened, the LGBT rights, the gender inequality, that was something that was touching, that had some modern themes within a historical fiction.
Yeah, and you know, I worked hard to do that. I thought that was important, and wanted people to see, you know, what it was like, you know, during that time period, and what the mores were, and you know how you people had to react to that, and you know how they had to live their lives, you know. And that, and by the way, very many lives were ruined. Many lives, you know, when you talk about the McCarthy era and many of the Hollywood screenwriters and actors and leading people in Hollywood, you know, where lives were ruined, you know, completely ruined, were completely over, you know, by, you know, the hearings, and they couldn't find work, and you know, and so these are the things where, you know, we can't forget these things. They're, you know, we live in a turbulent time, but we can't forget history, you know, because, you know, unfortunately, also history has a way of repeating itself. And, you know, you need to be vigilant about, you know, letting people know about these things. So I'm proud of that.
Yeah, it was reflected. I'm grateful that it was. So I had a question. You dive into innovation within the makeup industry, and especially with the invention of mascara. So was that part real? Like, the mascara was invented in the 1930s, 1940s, or was that something that's fictionalized?
No, I think, you know, I did a lot of research on mascara, and, you know, it's, you know, one of the themes in the book is the race for the first mass market mascara. In the 1st of all, one of the things that I found fascinating was that, you know, I mean, mascara has a very unusual level of interest, you know, which also had to do with Egyptology. You know, when King Tut's tomb was discovered in the 1920s, you know, and they discovered sort of the black slashed eyes, you know, on King Tut, you know, it became coal, you know, which was used, you know, and, you know, that became sort of the rage. And so, you know, that there became an interest a little bit in mascara. And so also there were certain products that were on the market that unfortunately had lead in it, or there were things that, you know, certain substances that were used that created certain levels of blindness. So we take it for granted today that these products are safe and that they're hypoallergenic and all these things. But, you know, in those days, you know, you could put whatever you wanted out on the market. And if it was, you know, safe, it was safe. And if it wasn't, it wasn't, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, and then, you know, as it moved into the 20s and the 30s, there was a cake mascara. It was actually, you know, like a lump of coal, like a cake. And mm-hmm. and people would moisten it, and you would have a brush, and you'd put that on your eye. But the tube mascara with the brush, I mean, that was a technology that was developed later. And of course, you know, it was, you know, today when, you know, women, you know, can buy mascara and keep it in the bottom of their bag, you know, and it's, you know, mess free. And so there was a lot of things like clumping and mess that would staining on your hands. So the current products that we have today are much more, you know, they're safe and ingenious in many ways. And in some ways, we take them for granted. But at the time, you know, one must remember that this was not, you know, readily available to everyone at the price.
Yeah, I can imagine. I was like realizing, I was like, that's probably, it didn't exist. You know, it would come about, like, what we take things for, take for granted. You know, once upon a time, they were brand new invention. So that was a really great, you know, portrayal of an invention of something that I take for granted now in 2019, but the reality is that, you know, 100 years ago, that did not exist. And then the process of just finding the right formula, the finding the right brush, that was something that was pretty unique about it.
Right.
So in this book, you portray three powerful women. How much work was it to get into this character's mindset?
I've worked with many powerful women in my career, and having a bird's eye view and a front row seat to working with some of the great American female entrepreneurs. You know, I'm the first generation of men to have worked for the first generation of female entrepreneurs. And, you know, I see the drive and the ambition. And I was once had lunch with the famous Tina Brown, and she once said to me something that really stuck with me. She said, "Women don't think they can have it all. They can, they just can't have it all at the same time." Mm-hmm. And I thought that was so fascinating because men don't think that way. Mm-hmm. And I think that I give it to women. I give homage and respect to women based on that. Let me repeat the report. I give a lot of great respect to women for having to do the balancing act, you know, because I think that, like Tina said, you know, it's harder in some ways when I've talked to, you know, the female executives I work with, the balancing of family and work, they have told me, you know, is a bit harder. So that's brought to the book as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's reflected. It reflected, you know, how did they balance, you know, work, motherhood, you know, responsibilities, family, relationships. So it was reflected in the story. So that was great. That was a great point of view that you brought in.
Thanks.
Now let's get to a round of book recommendations. This is an opportunity for you to share with our audience what they should read next. So what is your favorite genre?
I love biographies. I have to say that. Because truth is stranger than fiction. And so, you know, again, you know, it's not when you, in the original question you asked me about research, you know, when you're reading I could read something and it could spur something from some completely different person, you know. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you know, let's say I read the biography of Gloria Swanson, who was a great film star, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, she had a very interesting life. And you know, was one of the most successful actresses, and she was, you know, one of the first people to have a studio. And so, you know, again, you know, I might draw some inspiration from that, even though I'm not writing about a female, you know, actress, you know, but mm-hmm. I know that she lived during the same period. And, you know, so, for example, what she wore and her fashion, some of those things, you know, might be taken into Rouge as an example. Mm-hmm. So I really, really love reading biographies, and biographies really influence me.
That's great. Who's your favorite author?
I mean, I have to say that I love Truman Capote because mm-hmm. I think that he, you know, his social observation and his wry sense of humor really always, you know, when I reread the work, it's just incredible, you know, and mm-hmm. he wrote things that really, you know, set off people, and he was almost banished from society, you know, mm-hmm. towards the end of his life because he wrote about his friends, you know, many of whom were, you know, prestigious people who became incensed that he wrote about them. And I don't think Truman thought at that time that he was doing anything wrong, but he did, you know, and so he lost a lot of his friends along the way. And mm-hmm. I think he just thought of himself as a great artist, you know, but the truth is that, you know, when you read Answered Prayers and you read that book again, and, you know, the frankness about his sexuality and, you know, his, you know, one of the characters in the book is, you know, a gigolo, and it's just, you know, it's so modern. It's so incredibly controversial. And, you know, and so I'm sure when the book came out, which was, you know, in many ways based on, you know, his own life, I mean, I think it really is, it's so eye-opening and so incredibly fresh, you know, it stands the test of time. So I'm a huge Truman Capote fan.
I love it. What are your top three favorite books of all time?
Well, Answered Prayers, definitely. Do you know what I'm saying? And La Côte Basque, and within Answered Prayers is, you know, the is about the society, you know, the ladies who lunch. I mean, it's probably the ultimate, you know, book on that. I have to put The Great Gatsby as well, because, you know, it's really one of the finest American novels ever written. And, you know, the way the story's told through the narrator, I mean, I think it's just incredible. And it's just finely honed, you know, and crafted. And, you know, I'll tell you something that other people might not say, but I have to tell you that when I first read The Other Side of Midnight by Sidney Sheldon, I just thought it was, you know, a page turner. And so for me, you know, the idea of writing something literary, but wanting people to not be able to put it down, I mean, I think that's incredible. So the idea is, you know, can you mix the two? Can you have a really well-written book that people don't want to put down? And the reviews of Rouge have been that, and that's what I really am proud of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't put it down. I read it in one setting. And usually for historical fiction, it takes me, I put it down, I go back, and you know, this was, for me, Rouge was like a one-sitting book, which is a sign of a good book for me.
Thank you so much.
So what book have you read this year that you love?
Well, you know, I read the biography of Gloria Swanson, and I have to say that, you know, I was just struck by her life. I was struck by, you know, that she was the highest paid performer in the world at one point, and that she had an affair with Joe Kennedy, who, you know, really in many ways she thought was going to help her, and many ways, you know, ruined her financially, according to the book. And, you know, it was just an incredible read. I mean, and her life story, you know, and then how she came back in her 50s and won an Oscar for Sunset Boulevard. I mean, again, it's a triumph for, you know, I'm really attracted to strong characters, and she was real. So, you know, I mean, quite beautiful, but also so talented. So I just loved reading that book. I thought it just, you know, it summed up the 20s for me, and, you know, Hollywood and the, you know, golden age of Hollywood. And it was just incredible.
That's awesome. Tell us where we can find you online.
You can find me online at, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook, you know, and on Instagram at Richard_Kirschenbaum, KirschenBaum. I know it's a long name. It actually means cherry tree in German. So I'm actually Mr. Cherry Tree Kirschenbaum. I've sort of been really enjoying, you know, interacting with people who like the book, and you know, look forward to, you know, continuing my writing.
Thank you so much for being in the show.
I really appreciate you having me. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard, for a great interview. For show notes and a list of books mentioned in this podcast, please visit whattoreadnextblog.com. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back this Thursday with an author interview.
Are you an author, publisher, or book-related business looking to reach passionate readers? What to Read Next podcast is a perfect place to connect with an engaged audience of romance and mystery lovers who are always on the hunt for their next great read. Now, we're offering sponsorship opportunities. Whether you're launching a new book, promoting an upcoming release, showcasing a bookish product or services, we can help you get the word out. Let's work together to bring your books or businesses to readers who are ready to discover something new. Please visit whatreadnextblog.com/sponsorships. To learn more or reach out to chat about the perfect sponsorship or package for you. Thank you once for listening. Your next great reader is waiting for you.